Law Focus Podcast, bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Law Focus. My name is Millicent Ndiweni and I am not alone. I am with my colleague attorney.
Tsepo Mohapi, hello.
And together we will be your voice of law for the evening right here on VFM 88.1. So there was an article that was written by Justice Edwin Cameron in 2016, which spoke out of minimum sentences. And some of the details of that article were quite interesting.
Yeah.
At the time, there were 160,000 inmates. And he, you know, he spoke about how 21 billion rand is spent per year on
housing inmates and so on.
Exactly, yeah. That. So
that's quite an interesting, but it's a long read. But it's quite an interesting one.
It was. I thought the numbers were appalling, but interesting, definitely. And I think that's why we need to talk about minimum sentences in South Africa.
So certain offences will carry a minimum sentence if you are convicted of them. And then the court will apply that minimum sentence under normal circumstances, unless there's a reason to deviate, and which is what we're discussing today.
Absolutely. And we're obviously going to have expert opinions. We've got with us Phineas Mokoena. He is a legal practitioner who works at the regional courts in Krugersdorp, as well as Professor Stephen Chuson. I hope I pronounced it correctly.
Yes, I think that's about right. I think it's Chuson.
He is a Wits professor and academic, and he's dealt extensively. He works at the Wits Clinic, and criminal law is one of his expertise. So
yes,
he's
yes.
definitely going to also delve into this matter.
Yeah. Now, this wouldn't be a conversation without your input. And if you wish to take part in the conversation, you can send us a tweet using the hashtag LawFocus at VowFM. You are tuned into LawFocus VowFM 88.1. Let's stay tuned in for the upcoming discussion on minimum sentencing. But before we get there, let's take a look at the headlines which made the week.
Interesting news this week.
That's
our
right.
legal hotspots.
Sorry.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week. Yes. Legal hotspots.
So in our first story this evening, there has been an uproar in some of the UKZN campuses by students of SASCO, the South African Student Congress Organization. And some of the issues that they are raising in their protests include academic exclusion, issues of NASFAs, postgraduates who have not received their money for food and funding. And the campuses that have been reported on thus far include Westville, Durban University of Technology, and the Howard campus.
Yeah.
And, well, of course, lectures have been disrupted. The violence has resulted in some tear gassing. One student thus far has been arrested.
Yeah, let's hope that situation doesn't get too out of hand, hey?
Or spread.
Yeah.
And then in our second story, we've got the Army, the South African Defense Force, has been deployed to the Cape Flats in Cape Town. We know that it's a community that is rife with gangsterism and a lot of violence.
A very high rate of violence and gun violence in particular.
And so they're going to be there for the next 3 months monitoring the situation. Some people have obviously welcomed them, saying we'll probably have less innocent killings because we've got the army here. Whereas some gang members have said, you know what, whether the army is here or not, still, the Popo can't dance and it's still going to be like, you know, business as usual. They actually, interestingly, have said, we are not drug dealers. We are small business owners. How interesting is that?
And I'm a legitimate businessman.
I thought it was interesting.
That sounds very familiar.
And they continue to say, we are in cahoots with the police, so nothing really is going to change. I was just counting the number of gangs that are there. If I can just name some of them, Dixie Boys, Funky Junkie, G-Units. I think about 7 different gangs in one community. How insane is that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the police are inundated, and let's see whether this will help. I'm wondering why it's only a 3-month deployment, actually. But we'll see what happens there.
Definitely.
The public protector is again in the news today, and it hasn't been a good week. Eh? The Concord delivered a judgment yesterday on her appeal against a punitive cost order which was granted against her by the Pretoria High Court some time back. It relates to the South African Reserve Bank and the Bankcorp Absa matter, a report that she made. And the court basically found that she did not have a sound understanding of her constitutional duty and her mandate. She was biased, failing to be impartial, and she acted in bad faith.
Mm.
What the court was polite about was that there were some falsehoods that were presented to her in especially with regard to a meeting with Zuma and so on. It can be a very, very, this could have very, very serious consequences for the public protector. The only glimmer of hope that she has is that the dissenting judgment by Justice Mokgweng and Justice Goliath didn't agree with the cost order, but they were just as scathing in assessing her competence to do the work and so on.
One of her explanations to the courts, which is almost like her shooting herself in the foot, was when she said that she was really confused when she was filing very important court papers. You know, it's almost like you saying, I'm not sure if I'm fit for this role, I'm not sure if I'm competent enough, because you should be able to manage and juggle everything with very sound understanding, but unfortunately that was not the case.
Yeah. And I mean, it could have a professional impact on her as well, because Accountability Now, an NGO, has already written to the Legal Practice Council requesting that she be struck from the role as an advocate.
That's even worse than just being removed as public protector.
Yeah, for lying under oath, basically. Again, it's Minister Pravin Gordhan and the public protector again. Their matter is in court. It's with relation to in the Pretoria High Court as well. It's in relation to the SARS Rogue Unit and a finding by the public protector that Gordhan acted improperly in that matter. It has been a strange form, you know, it's a little bit of a strange case, because there's been quite a few personal attacks there from the recordings that I've heard, or from the reports that I've heard. The public protector hasn't opposed as such, but has made certain submissions in respect to what she calls a personal attacks. A very interesting style of litigating by Gordhan, I must say. I've taken note of that. I don't know about the merits of it, but his style of litigation is awkward.
And I mean, it has included other persons as well, the president and the EFF weighing in on the matter.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that goes. But on the back of this last ruling, I'm nervous. I would be nervous if I was the public protector, eh?
Thank goodness you're not.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely need to stay tuned. We are discussing minimum sentences. Remember, you can tweet us on @VowFM using the hashtag LawFocus. Keep tuned. We'll be back after this break.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week is Legal Hotspots. Listening to Law Focus? Connect with VowFM 88.1 on Twitter and Facebook. Be your own lawyer.
Welcome back to the show, Law Focus, with Tapo and Millicent. We are discussing minimum sentences, and we are now introducing our first guest on the show. His name is Mr. Phineas Mokgweng. He is a legal practitioner, and he's going to share with us his expertise on the matter. Good evening, Mr. Phineas, and welcome to Law Focus.
Good evening, Millicent.
Yeah.
Good evening, Tapo. Good evening to the listeners. Indeed, I'm Phineas Mokgweng, coming from Legalist South Africa, but I am based at Krugersdorp local office.
Awesome.
This is I'm practicing from. I've been in that office from the 1st of July 2007. Okay. So I've been in that office for over a period of 12 years.
Oh, awesome.
Yes,
awesome.
We are defending the voiceless, the defenseless, and the poor at Legal Aid.
Definitely.
Yes.
So minimum sentences, how did you get involved with that?
Of course, I'm working at the regional court. I'm a regional court legal practitioner. So that is how you get involved, because we are dealing there with offenses which are very, very serious, which actually attract the minimum sentences. Here we are talking of offenses such as murder, offenses such as rape, such as robbery. These are the offenses which are attracting minimum sentences. So that is how I got involved into dealing with the so-called minimum sentences. And there is a legislation which is actually governing these type of sentences.
Well, we are happy to have you, because you also wrote an interesting legal research paper, particularly on this very topic. So you are obviously the best person whom we can talk to. What is minimum sentences? How should we understand it?
Yes, you know, I decided to write an article on this aspect because, you know, it is. I've been always asked questions, especially by my clients or any ordinary people in the street. They will always ask you about what is this minimum sentences? How does it work? How does it apply? So that is how I decided to just write a brief article about it. This minimum sentences, as I've indicated earlier on, is being governed by the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 105, of 1997. The legislature felt that it was prudent to can actually come up with this legislation in view of the fact that it transpired that there are these offences that have included your murder, your rape, your robberies, which have been very, very serious, and they seem to be escalating and always skyrocketing. So that is when now the legislature felt that no, they have to come up with this idea of minimum sentences. So the main idea, of course, was actually to try to cap these offences to see if they cannot be reduced. Hence the formation or the promulgation of this law, which is now called Criminal Law Amendment Act.
And do you think that's working?
Indeed, it is working. I can rest assure you. For instance, if you can look at the fact that let me make an example of a murder case. Depending on the facts of each case, a case or an offence may attract a minimum sentence of 15 years for a first time offender, a second time offender it can be 20 years, then the third time offender 25 years, and so forth. If the murder has been premeditated, in layman's term we say if it was planned, it attracts a minimum sentence of life imprisonment. So you can see that to a certain extent, in fact not to a certain extent, it does actually work, because it serves as a deterrence, you know, to the offenders, to the would-be offenders, to the community at large. We are actually sending a strong message to the effect that minimum sentences are there, they are actually effective. So I really believe, and strongly so, to the effect that they are really working.
Now, when we're standing there in front of a magistrate or a judge, and now our client has been convicted, right?
Yes.
And we say, well, these are the circumstances. Take this into account. Please think about this. We say, and the offense. And we take all these things and we say, now come up with a sentence. Does the Minimum Sentence Act help when you are arguing in mitigation for a client, or does it hinder, does it bind the judge too much? When can the judge say, okay, the minimum sentence doesn't apply?
Okay, now this is what happens. In fact, I omitted to highlight something. The section which is actually dealing with this minimum sentence is called Section 51. It is called Section 51, Subsection 1, Subsection 2, as well as Subsection 3. Well, there are other subsections, but most importantly, we always deal with these three subsections. As I've indicated, let me go back to an example of a murder case. If a person now has been convicted and he has to be sentenced now for a period of 15 years, if let's say he has committed an offense which attracts a minimum sentence of 15 years direct imprisonment. Yeah. Now, it is upon me as an attorney now from Legal Aid South Africa to can now convince the court to can say that, look, Your Worship, this person does not deserve this type of sentence. The law applies, allows me as an attorney to can convince the court otherwise. That one is now governed by Section 51, Subsection 3. Then that one is talking about, that is Section 51, Subsection 3 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act 105 of 1997. It actually allows me as an attorney now to can present substantial and compelling reasons. In layman's term, if I can try to simplify what this substantial and compelling reasons, this phrase, what it means. It meaning that I have to now come up with some convincing reasons for the court to can now, for me to can say to the court, please, Your Worship, can do not impose a minimum sentence of 15 years direct imprisonment as it is legislated. Now, of course, there is a case law to that effect. As an attorney, I have to go and make a research. I have to come up with decided cases to say, based on this case law or these decided cases, usually it would be high court decision cases, SC decisions, questionnaire court decisions. I would say that based on these decisions, I am of the view that the court cannot impose such a sentence. If it means I have to postpone the case for me to go and prepare or get further information to consult with the client or to consult with the family of the client, I will have to do that in order to can get these factors so that I can convince the court. Remember, if I don't do that, the client stands a chance of going to prison for at least 15 years if I'm not good enough or if I'm not putting a convincing argument before the court. So it is always my duty to can do that.
But now, typically, what would be the consideration that would allow the court to deviate from the minimum sentence?
Factors such as the following. The fact that, let's say, I will always go back to this example that I have made of murder. Let's say a client is a first-time offender.
Okay.
He has not been on the wrong side of the law previously. Mm. Maybe he had been in prison for some time. Maybe for
awaiting trial, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, awaiting trial before the matter could be finalized. Mm. Maybe for a year or more. Then this perhaps, if maybe he's on bail or he was on bail, I would state the fact that maybe this person is a breadwinner, he has got a family to support. If he's going to prison for such a long period, the family will suffer, etc., etc. Mm. So basically, I'll be putting before the court the personal circumstances which actually favor the client. In most cases, you'll find that in a case of murder, it happened at a tavern, alcohol played a role, etc., etc. So there are always various factors depending on each particular case, which one would can always present before court and say, these are the factors, Your Worship, please consider them. These are regarded as I don't have to come up with extraordinary circumstances. As I've indicated earlier on, the case law is clear on that. I always have to come up with convincing reasons, not really extraordinary circumstances. Yes.
And but you speak very, very passionately for minimum sentences. Who do they actually serve? Is it the accused? What about the families who are affected by the crime, the states? Who exactly do these minimum sentences serve?
They actually serve parties who are affected by the crime itself. For instance, when the court sentences an accused for a case of murder, it will always indicate that it is going to take into account three factors: interests of the community, the personal circumstances of the accused, the interest of the victim or victims.
The gravity of the crime.
The gravity of the crime, yes. Those are the factors which are always taken into account. So at the end of the day, it affects all the parties who have been affected. That is how I could actually answer your question.
So you wouldn't say that there's any rights in the Bill of Rights that might be violated against because of minimum sentences? You don't see it that way?
In that regard, I would say, of course, because remember, let's say in a case of murder, a person is sentenced to 15 years direct imprisonment. Obviously, the freedom of movement comes to the fore, because now he's no longer going to have any freedom of movement. He's inside in custody, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. He has to, whatever he wants to express, he or she can do it through myself or the family. So such rights get affected. But let's not forget the fact that Section 36 of the Constitution Act 108 of 1996 also has got a limitation in whatever rights that we are having. So at the end of the day, one has to consider all the factors, consider the law in general. We cannot say, because now this person has got these rights, what about the rights of the victim? What about the rights of the society or the community? What about the limitation as entrenched by Section 36 of the Constitution?
All right. So now tell me. You deal with the regional court, okay, which is perhaps the more senior court of the lower courts. Huh?
Yes.
Above that, you have the high court and the rest of them. Eh? And you will find, let's say that a person is now up for life sentence. They've now been convicted. They're going to go, they're potentially facing a life sentence. What will happen? Will that matter still be heard in the regional court for sentencing? Will it be referred? Or if they are sentenced to life in the regional court, let's assume they are for now, what happens after that? Is the regional court okay? Is that where it stops? Is there an appeal process automatically they kick? What happens?
Thanks, Sepp.
It's a very serious one, that one.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I agree with you, Sepp. Now, what happens is that, maybe I omitted to actually highlight something. The Criminal Law Amendment Act, as I've indicated, 105 of 1977, came into operation in May 1998. And since then, from time to time, it has been amended. Initially, only the High Court or the High Courts had jurisdiction to can impose life imprisonment. Then, as time went by, then this actually raised some criticism. Yeah. Because now, before that, what would happen is that the lower court, being the regional court, would, for example, convict in layman's term, meaning that find someone guilty. Yes.
But they will not be able to...
Exactly. Then they would transfer the matter to High Court for sentencing. Then the legislation or the legislature felt that it is necessary now to amend this Criminal Law Amendment Act 105 of 1997, the very same Section 51. It was amended to the effect that the lower courts, that is the regional courts now, were given jurisdiction now to can impose life sentences in respect of cases such as rape, your murder. And this amendment now was effected on the Criminal Law Amendment Act 38 of 2007. So from that period, since it came into operation from 2007, the regional courts now have got jurisdiction now to can impose life imprisonment on cases such as murder and rape. As I've indicated, if a murder has been planned or premeditated, life imprisonment is applicable. If a rape of a child has been raped, or a victim has been raped by more than one or two perpetrators, such cases warrant that life imprisonment be imposed. So regional courts now have jurisdiction to can impose life imprisonment since the year 2007.
But now, is it true that an automatic review kicks in once the regional court convicts you and sentences you to life? Does an automatic appeal or an automatic review kick in at that stage?
That is an automatic appeal. Okay. But then on that aspect, maybe I just need to highlight something. Even though it is automatic, does not necessarily mean that a person who has been found guilty can just fold their arms and say, okay, because it is automatic, then I cannot do anything. Me as an attorney from Legally South Africa, I will always have to advise the client and perhaps help him in preparing the documents, because there are some documents. There is a judgment called notice of appeal that we have to prepare, which must be served and filed in the regional court as well as in the high court. Because if you do not do that, then nothing is going to happen to the case. Because immediately when I file those documents, then the record will be transcribed, then a process can start, then the client can the client's matter can be taken to high court, then the matter will be attended to. That is what it means by this automatic leave to appeal.
Definitely. Well, if you are tuned in right now, we are listening and you're hearing the voice of Mr. Phineas Mokoena, who is an attorney at Legal Aid South Africa, and he's giving us pearls of wisdom on minimum sentencing. We need to conclude the conversation right now, but before we do, Mr. Mokoena, minimum sentences sometimes give off the impression that something is being done about crime. What is your take on that? Is something being done about crime really because of minimum sentences, or is it just an impression?
I strongly believe that something is being done about crime. The fact that the legislature felt it fit or deemed it fit to can come up with this law in 1997, and from time to time it has been amended. That is why it amended the Section 51 to can now include the lower courts to can actually impose life imprisonment, because it realized that, you know what, this crime kept on moving up and up, especially the crime of rape and murder. That is why it decided that, no, you know what, even the lower court, being the magistrate court, can now have jurisdiction to can actually impose a higher sentence. We have actually made an example of Western Cape when you spoke earlier on, whereby it is a well-known fact that the crime of murder is very high in that province. So
it's higher than the national average, I understand.
No, that's true. I believe so, because on average they tell us that per day so many people get killed in that province. Yeah. So I agree with you. So I believe as time goes on, even in other offenses, if the legislature is of the view that no, there has to be a need to can amend this Criminal Law Amendment Act in order to impose a higher sentence or higher sentences than the ones that are being imposed even now, I believe this is still going to do so. Hence, I believe that indeed we are on the right track.
So the future here is only going to grow and grow
Exactly. At the end of the day, it is the duty of the legislature to ensure that the committee is protected. And the only way to can protect it is by actually trying to close whatever loopholes are there in the law. Remember, just to wrap up, remember, for instance, in a case of murder, a person is sentenced to 15 years direct imprisonment, decade parole after having served 50% of that time period. More and more, more often, people re-offend. About 50% of the people that we represent in the regional court, you'll find that they've re-offended, they've got a previous conviction that is in layman's term criminal record. So taking into account such factors, one is inclined to believe that the legislature will sit down and say that, you know what, maybe this 15 years, as I've made an example of Western Cape, where people just die in an abnormal manner, you'll find that as time goes on, then they may feel that, okay, you know what, we have to amend this piece of legislation in order to close such loopholes.
Interesting one. Well, let's hear from you, the listener. Do you agree with Mr. Phineas Mokoena here that minimum sentences are a good way of fighting crime?
Hi, I'm anonymous. I'm studying film and TV. So I think there should be like a standard sentence for everyone. So if you murdered someone, for example, you should have, I don't know, maybe 25 years in prison. And it shouldn't matter like what type of murder it was. And if you rape someone, then it should be, I don't know, 35 years. So I think there should be just like an umbrella sentence for people. I think that's fair for everyone.
My view on whether minimum sentences are helping to reduce crime or not is that for certain things, like certain acts, I think that the minimum sentences don't do enough because, like, you know, when someone gets raped and they get a minimum sentence of, like, you know, 10 years instead of, you know, what they should be getting, I don't think that that's obviously going to minimize crime because, like, with anything in life, if you give someone a lesser punishment than what they deserve, they're not going to learn their lesson the way that they would have. So it's not going to help prevent crime. It's going to probably help perpetuate it, I think, yeah.
My view on this question is that, yes, minimum sentences do perpetuate crime because it for people who have not been in prison yet and people who have not been able to, who have not committed crimes yet and are considering it, it makes it a bit more appealing because the consequences aren't that harsh. And I think that even though I say so, it's important to also mention the fact that just the idea of putting someone in prison for committing a crime as a way to stop crime from occurring is not really effective. So even if you give a minimum wage, a minimum your sentence, and also like be extremely harsh, it still won't affect the psyche of that person.
I think that the minimum sentence will also perpetuate crime because I think different crimes have different circumstances that are attached to them. Some are extenuating circumstances which actually don't define the crime well, and therefore some rape cases, especially rape cases, will be different compared to other rape cases where they deserve a higher sentence. Therefore, I think minimum sentences actually perpetuate crime and do not help crime.
Crime ayizukwehla ngenxa yokuba kukho i-minimum sentences ngenxa yokuba umntu uyakwazi uba ngaba uzoseva i-sentence encinci and nabanye in the society bayazi uba ngaba umntu okhomithe that crime uzohlala ixesha elincinci, so ivele yenze nje like abantu bazoyenza ngexesha like bazohleli beyenza. So I would say mna ayizuyehlisa i-crime ngenxa yoba useva ixesha elincinci ejele.
And we're back. We're listening to Law Focus on Val 88.1. We're now going to speak to Professor Stephen Tusson, a law professor at the University of the Witwatersrand. Hello, Professor.
Good evening.
How are you, Professor? Are you well?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you.
We thank you so much for joining us this evening right here on Law Focus.
Good.
Yeah, well, our topic today is minimum sentencing. So, you know, we'd like to just have a little bit of a discussion about that. When looking at minimum sentencing, you know, normally sentencing would be a judicial sort of prerogative. But the minimum sentencing well, you know, it's the Criminal Amendment Act, but we call it the Minimum Sentencing Act. Is a parliamentary thing. Do you see an interference between the two, or is it a complementary relationship between the judiciary's prerogative and the and Parliament's sort of stipulation?
So what you're referring to is the separation of powers doctrine.
Yes.
It says that it's the legislator's job to make the laws, and it's the court's function to apply the laws. And one of those prerogatives, as you use the word, of the court is to decide on an appropriate sentence.
Yes, that's
for an offender.
That's right.
And so typically it would be inappropriate for the legislature to set hard minimum sentences in which there is absolutely no wiggle room.
So it's
not called the Minimum Sentencing Act, it's called the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which enacted the minimum sentences in Section 51. And there was a constitutional court challenge to the section making that exact argument, and the court found that it was appropriate for the legislature to give guidance to the courts of what the community feels is an appropriate sentence for very serious crimes, provided the sentence is rational and reasonable and it follows the usual sentencing guidelines, such as you mentioned, the circumstances of the accused, the individual, you know, how young or old they are, or how many times they've previously committed offences. And we need to look at the seriousness of the particular offence and so on. So what they did to save the statute from unconstitutionality was to allow the court at discretion by saying that it must impose these minimum sentences unless there are substantial and compelling circumstances to impose a lesser sentence. And the Constitutional Court found that saved the section from unconstitutionality because it still vested a discretion in the courts to impose an appropriate sentence.
All right. Okay, that's good. And now, we know that an offender will ordinarily not serve a full sentence. Say he's sentenced to 15 years. It's unlikely that he'll do a full 15 years. There may be other factors, such as parole and so on, which kick into it. What effect is this, for instance, how does it interplay with parole or other factors which can impact on sentencing? So how does minimum sentencing have an effect on those?
All right, so the principle is that the court is obliged to impose the minimum sentence. And so some examples are for aggravated murder, which is particularly awful murder, where you rape someone and then murder them, or you kill a cop, or you armed robbery with a firearm and you murder someone. It's prescribed that the penalty is life imprisonment. So the minimum that a person sentenced to life imprisonment must serve is 25 years before he becomes eligible for parole. So they can't be eligible for parole before 25 years. There are certain exceptions, and I must just mention that the parole law is very complicated. It's complicated by the fact that there's been amendments over the years, and so prisoners who are sentenced in one decade get different rules for parole than prisoners who are sentenced later and recently. So you can never make a general rule about a particular prisoner because it depends when you are sentenced. But basically, life imprisonment, the offender needs to serve a minimum of 25 years before he's eligible for parole. But if they're over 65 years and if they have served at least 15 years, they could be eligible. And so your example of 15 years for, say, robbery. The general rule is at least half of the sentence must be served before it can be eligible for parole.
Right.
So yes, parole does have an effect in that it does typically reduce the actual sentence that the accused must serve.
All right. Okay. And then, so for in another example where often an offender will be convicted of multiple offences for one action, say murder, possession of illegal firearm, possession of of illegal ammunition, and let's say the minimum sentence then applies of 15 years. Would he be sentenced in addition to the murder? Would he sentence for the possession of the illegal firearm and ammunitions? Would that typically be placed on top? or would that now just form part of the minimum, you know, the time that he serves under the murder? Because, I mean, the minimum sentence is in relation to the murder, not to the other two offences.
So basically what your question is asking is if he has a minimum sentence or mandatory sentence of 15 years for murder, 15 years for armed robbery, must he serve 30 years or 15 years? And that depends, and it depends entirely on the judge and the discretion of the judge. It's the judge's prerogative to decide whether these sentences are to run consecutively, which means one after the other, which is a total of 30 years, or concurrently, which means they both begin at the same time and they run together, which means he will serve 15 years. So as he's complying with the act, if he sentences the person to the minimum sentence, but it's his decision whether they run concurrently or consecutively.
Right. Okay.
And do you think that it was important for South Africa to actually introduce minimum sentences? Does it help curb crime?
There is a very interesting speech by Mr. Justice Edwin Cameron, who's a constitutional court judge. He gave a speech at a university where it's worth quoting. His opinion is minimum sentences are poorly thought out, misdirected, hugely costly, and above all, ineffective way of punishing criminals. They have a pernicious effect on our correctional system, the offenders in it, and most of all us, the society. They offer us a false promise, the belief that we are actually doing something about crime and we are not. This false belief lets those who are responsible, that's the government, for effectively dealing with crime off the hook. And I can only agree with Mr. Justice Cameron. There was an explosion of crime in the New Democracy in 1994. Government was hard-pressed to be seen to be doing something. There was already a commission looking at how to deal with sentencing. Parliament didn't have the benefit of the results of this commission, and they just imposed our minimum sentencing legislation. And it just does not work on any level. There are levels of rehabilitation. Minimum sentences do not rehabilitate people. It makes them worse. There's an argument that if you keep them out of the system for long enough, they become old and weak and they won't be so dangerous anymore. But that there's some justification for that. But it's just, if you look at every single measure of effective sentencing policy, they do not work.
Prof, just to play perhaps devil's advocate a little here, isn't it just as important that justice be done as justice be seen to be done? Isn't that part of the reasoning that if I commit this crime and then if I'm caught, I mean, that's a big if, that I may go to jail for the rest of my life, and that sort of deterrent factor was a consideration when coming up with the legislation, don't you think?
The research has shown that no one contemplating serious crime considers, oh, if I do this, I'll get life or 15 years minimum. I better think twice about it. It's been demonstrated over and over again that some of them don't even know what sentences they face for their conduct. Plus, there's the considered crime approach, which says that the people consider their crimes before they commit them. And it's just demonstrated that it does not happen. So it has no effect insofar as deterrence. If anything, it scares you and I, law-abiding citizens, gosh, better keep my nose clean. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I could go to jail for a long time, but no. So, you know, I don't want to pull rank on you, but the research seems to suggest that's not an argument.
All right. And, you know, South Africa does have a very serious crime problem, and perhaps one of the arguments would be, but if we have a minimum sentencing provisions, that we actually aren't dealing with the root cause. We're actually only dealing with the people that we can catch, because it only applies once the person's caught. The more important consideration would be apprehending them and then bringing them to trial and being able to prepare for trial correctly in order to facilitate a good, you know, a successful prosecution, and that our resources should be focused there and not at the tail end of it. What would you say about that?
I can only agree with you. We have a very, very low enforcement rate. and the prospects. I think the most effective deterrent is the certainty of being caught and prosecuted and punished. And I think most criminals are thinking it's worth the candle to take the system on because of under-resourced prosecution services, under-resourced policemen, incompetence, corruption, and all sorts of issues. And so I can only agree with you.
So if you do agree with that thought, then what do you think should come in if minimum sentences don't work? What really is it that we can use as a country to fight and curb crime?
I can only again quote Judge Edwin Cameron, who says that we need to build our criminal justice systems. We need to train detectives and police personnel. We need to improve our blood analysis. Do you know that if you get caught for drunken driving, it could take 10 years for your blood sample to be analyzed? Mm-hmm. There are so many back samples at the laboratories that they just cannot possibly get to them. And so that is the kind of thing that Judge Cameron is talking about. We need to beef up the system. There should be no shortcuts in the criminal justice system. We need to preserve people's dignity, and justice must follow. Must devote resources to proper standards of care, proper trained prosecutors. The suggestion is that we should scrap minimum sentences for low-level, non-violent, non-serious crimes. It's ridiculous. There was an experiment for minimum sentence for Dacha, which just was a terrible experiment. There should be community service sentences. There should be consultation with the victims, and restorative justice should be considered. We need to replace the mandatory sentencing with a sentencing council, develop good research-based sentencing guidelines. It's a huge topic.
Wow, okay, no, that definitely is interesting. It sounds very academic, but hopefully the academia and the praxis can be put together so that we can actually have a proper developmental system within the criminal system of South Africa.
Good.
Definitely. Thank you. Yes, Professor?
No, thank you very much.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Yeah, so the professor's views, they are perhaps a little bit different to many other people's.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only attest to what I've seen in court and the reaction of a client who receives a minimum sentence of 15 years.
What's it like?
Or, the gallery and his family and those around him. It is a devastating sentence to get. And I can tell you, anyone walking out of that courtroom will not dare commit that crime. I can tell you that. He does make some very good points as well, that it's a lot more than just sentencing which we need to curb crime. But it is important that justice seem to be done.
We'll take a short ad break, and when we come back, we will continue to wrap up.
Law Focus. Point of information.
And we're back at Law Focus on BioFM 88.1. Mr. Mugwana is back with us. I just wanted to ask you, when you see the minimum sentencing being implemented, what impact have you seen it having, say, on the victim of the crime and their families, perhaps if the victim is deceased, and perhaps even the families of the accused? What's the impact that you see on it?
Firstly, with the family with the victim, as you have said, maybe in a case of murder where the family would have lost a loved one. Definitely, when a person is sentenced to, for instance, 15 years direct imprisonment, then at least they know for a fact that for 7 years and a half or so, they cannot see that person for some years. At least that gives them an opportunity to can heal, you know. And maybe I also had to add, the law allows the family of the victim to can actually have a say when a person has to be given a parole. In most cases, the court will always explain to them that, look, when this person has to be given a parole, you'll have to be contacted. If not, you'll have to check with the correctional services from time to time. If you don't want this person to be released on parole, it is all right. You'll have to state your reasons, whatever.
Yes.
The processes that are being done by the correctional services.
And those submissions are taken into consideration.
Definitely.
Although they're not binding on the parole
board, but
they're taken into consideration.
Of course, they're taken into consideration. With the family of the client they accused, you know, because I'm always for the accused.
Yes.
I always feel pity.
Aren't we all?
I always feel pity when a person goes to prison for a period of 15 years, irrespective of the fact that they will get a parole or not.
What about which crime they committed? Doesn't that matter? Ish.
Look, remember, when I am in court, I've got a professional duty to represent my client, and not only to do so, but to do so to the best of my ability, to render service excellence. When a person is convicted of whatever offense for that matter, it doesn't go down well with me, because to me it appears as if I didn't do enough.
Yeah.
You know, so I would always have to speak to the family of the accused, you know, try to tell them, like, okay, you know what, we can always appeal the matter. If the appeal fails, we can always petition and see if we cannot get a lesser sentence, etc. But then in most cases, because you'll find that the accused has a family, he was a breadwinner, or even if he's not a breadwinner, but then he was providing bid for the children or for the wife or certain members of the family. So you'll find that in most cases, it has got a negative effect, that is the sentence, be it to the accused and or to the deceased family.
Oh, wow, okay. I mean, it's always important to remember that there are the human factors behind these stories. And once they come out, I don't know how involved you are with offenders after they come out of prison, but in your experience, what is the effect, not necessarily for someone who's been given a minimum sentence, but anyone who's gone to prison, what is the effect? Are they reformed when they come back? Professor Toussaint emphasizes the fact that I suppose many of them, particularly long-term prisoners, would come back and be now hardened criminals and not be rehabilitated at all. In your experience, how do people come out of prison, and what are they like when they come out of prison? Does it perform the function of rehabilitation?
Well, on few occasions, I would represent a client who has been convicted, you know. Maybe you'll find out I was representing this person 5 years down the line, then all of a sudden he's before court again. Well, it does not really happen very, very often. It happens once in a while. Mm-hmm. So I believe, even though, of course, we can differ insofar as this aspect is concerned, I believe to a certain extent, in view of the fact that they don't always come before that particular court that I'm working in or at. So I have the impression that maybe there's a sort of rehabilitation of some sort. But then another aspect, though, that one has to deal with and cannot ignore is the fact that our prisons are overcrowded. I think you did allude to that effect when we started this program. Our prisons are overcrowded. As a result, one is inclined to believe that there is no proper rehabilitation and or reformation in prison, because I don't think the prison authorities have got enough opportunity to can attend to them and see if they are properly rehabilitated. So we cannot lose sight of that fact. But at the end of the day, we are inclined to believe that there are some programs, because from time to time there will be probation officers who will come to court, especially with these serious offenses. If a person has been sentenced, it will be sentenced to life imprisonment in murder case, premeditated, or rape of a minor or a child, then we will always get a pre-sentence report. So the probation officer, usually someone who will come from, is a social worker coming from the correctional services, he will prepare this report. So to a certain extent, those reports do help in order to assist or to work into the relationship rehabilitation or the reformation of an offender.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. I found it to be a very technical topic. I don't know if Tepo has any final words before we close.
Well, I mean, only to conclude that crime is very rife in our country, and that I suppose one has to treat like cases the same. And the purpose of the Act, the amendment, and the provisions is to try and to standardize the treatment of particular crimes. So if you commit a category of a crime which falls into this category, whether it is now a rape or it's a murder, this type of murder, this type of robbery, we then say, give us a reason. The court then says, give us a reason why you shouldn't go to jail for 10 years or for 15 years or for 20 years or life, whatever the case may be. And that gives us a measure by which me and you standing on the street can measure justice and say, if you commit this offense, you deserve to go to jail for 15 years, for 10 years, for however long it is. And from that point of view, it's reassuring. Of course, Professor Toussaint has mentioned all of its shortfalls, which are valid. But I think it is still something that is required, particularly in the context of South Africa, and one that doesn't have all of the resources, doesn't have a judiciary or a justice system that is perfectly working and smooth operating system. Even if we have some of our flaws in the minimum sentencing, we can still use it to our benefit, perhaps, to remove the elements of society which we don't deem fit to be with us, at least for a period of time. So that would be my contribution. Even with its flaws, I think it has a use, and it can be implemented correctly, and it does have some kind of benefit to society at large.
Absolutely. Okay, that is the beauty of having legal experts on the show, as well as having different views, because then we all get educated and we can make an informed decision on what aspects of the show we are going to agree with and we will not agree with. But for now, I would like to thank you very much, Mr. Phineas Mokwena from Legal Aid, for joining us. You were excellent. You gave us all your expert wisdom, and we appreciate you being on the show this evening here on Law Focus.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and thank you so much from Tsepo, Boitumelo from Legal Aid. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And of course, we also had our vice academic, Mr. Brother Professor Stephen Toussaint, who also joined us this evening to speak to us on minimum sentences, and we'd like to also send out our gratitude to him. We do have podcasts. Iono.fm is where you can go if you would like to catch any of our other shows. But you can always continue the conversation. Remember, it's at VowFM using the hashtag LawFocus for any other additional input that you might have. Up next is a total package with Caesar the MC, DLXL, as well as Celeste King. From our producer Simbahonde, our technical producer Kutlwano Sirame, our Law Focus researchers Sise Tuzingelwa, Nelka Mamate, Khalaletsang, Khami, Sipati Makafani, Tepo Mohapi, and myself, Millicent Ndiweni. Thank you for tuning into Law Focus tonight. Good night.
Law Focus on Zolfan 88.1, point of information. Law Focus Podcast.